somebody should at least bring up something. That if you can't bring up any redeeming, extenuating circumstance, we have to suspect that the procedure was not an honest and objective procedure. Okay. Be it as it may, the question that we have is the following. And again, circumstantial evidence is not admissible. The famous case the Gemara gives is what? Two witnesses see a guy chasing after another guy with a knife. Reuven running after Shimon. They then go into a building, so they're temporarily obscured from sight. The witnesses run in. Reuven is standing over Shimon with blood dripping from the knife, and Shimon is dead. Now they saw Reuven running after Shimon. They saw Reuven standing over the dead body of Shimon. But they did not actually see the knife go into Shimon's body. The Gemara tells us that that is not sufficient, because maybe Shimon had grabbed the knife from Reuven and there was a scuffle and Reuven finally killed Shimon in self-defense, etc. And consequently, that wouldn't be sufficient evidence. Okay, so the question you might ask from a theological standpoint is this. What is the purpose of the Torah giving us so many examples of capital punishment if it's never going to be applied? It's never going to be applied. How could capital punishment be a deterrent from sin? In fact, it's the same debate we have now. Capital punishment is, except in some states like Texas or whatever it is, capital punishment is on the books in many states, but it's very hard to get. Right? People can appeal it for 10, 20, 20 years, etc. So the question is, capital punishment cannot deter if people are pretty sure they're not going to get it. So one answer is this. One answer is that the purpose of the Torah putting in capital punishments for its averos is educational rather than practical. Meaning to say, by impressing on a religious populace that certain averot are so serious that they are deserving of the death penalty, there's a certain educational message there in terms of the sanctity of life and other things. So a punishment can serve a very important educational function, even if it's not actually administered. It alerts us to the sensitivity and the moral opprobrium that is associated with a particular act. We should also say, too, that if one is a believer in God, no criminal ever escapes. So you say, the guy got off, right? We always say, the guy got off, the system doesn't work. But the truth is, in a theological sense, there's no such thing as getting off. Whatever limitations there are on a human court does not preclude the ultimate operation of divine justice. So, in a way, the concept of the criminal getting off is simply not true in a Jewish perspective. It may not be in this world, it may be in the next world, it may not be now, it may be later, etc. But there's no such thing as getting off. So, you know, those are two things here. But there's a third point, and that goes back to your question about the non-Jew. And that is, the Rambam writes that there can exist, it's based on Gemara's, there can exist a parallel system of justice that operates alongside the Sanhedrin that is not subject to the same list of rules. And the analogy would be martial law. Just the martial law, there are types of military emergencies in which normal law could be suspended. Well, the Rambam writes that when there is a state of lawlessness and violence and crime is on the increase, the melech, the king, is permitted, as it were, to establish alternative tribunals, alternative courts, which can sentence people to death or imprisonment, other types of punishments, on the basis of circumstantial evidence. So that you don't need the eyewitnesses without the requirements of warning. So in effect, when you have what is called mishpat hamelech, justice administered by the king's courts, a lot of these rules of evidence would not apply, and people can be sentenced to death or even alternative punishments like imprisonment, which is not even one of the normal punishments in the Torah, can be employed. Now, it's not really clear, does this state of emergency have to be declared by a melech on a national level, or can it be done locally or regionally? Could we say, for example, you know, New York City is in a state of emergency, and how long can there be a state of emergency? You know, one could see the problem here. You know, for example, in the United States, certain administrative orders for state of emergency were issued during the Korean War in the early 1950s, and they have never been rescinded. You know, so states of emergency can last, you know, 50 or 60 years. And The halacha is it's very strange. The halacha is relatively silent about the mechanics. We have extensive discussion of the Sanhedrin system, which is the official system. There's very, very little halachic discussion about the composition of the Mishpat HaMelech, although one suspects, there's absolute proof for this, that for many periods of Jewish history, the Mishpat HaMelech was actually the normal system that applied, rather than the Sanhedrin system. I'll mention this because the Sanhedrin system lapsed upon the destruction of the temple. The Mishpat HaMelech system could exist even when you don't have a Melech, when there's Jewish autonomy. So for example, during the Middle Ages, when Jewish communities did have judicial autonomy granted by the host nations, we have a lot of evidence of Jews even practicing the death penalty. And that could only be based on Mishpat HaMelech. It could not be based on Sanhedrin. And we even find punishments such as cutting off hands, etc., which are totally not Torah-based punishments, but they are based on the state of emergency regulations, which would permit even that type of thing. In fact, there's a very famous book, which has not been translated in English, but it's a very, very interesting book because it deals with this. It's called By Simcha Asaf, Mishpata Onshin Achar Talmud, which essentially means the administration of punishments, penal authority, by Jewish judges in the aftermath of the Talmud. So it's like a totally different thing. So it's not the Sanhedrin system at all. So in a sense, when you're operating under Mishpat HaMelech, non-Jewish testimony would be admissible. I should also say too that there's a separate rule for non-Jewish tribunals, which are constituted under the Noahide laws. Obviously, for administration of the Noahide laws, there is no requirement of Jewish witnesses. So they would be operating under a different system as well. So you really have multiple types of courts, each of which would have a different set of rules. Okay, yeah.
What does the Torah say about the concept of Hashem's punishments being tempered by whatever suffering and punishments the man receives in this world, and then he gets off, he doesn't get off there, but he gets punished here, he's less up there.
That's right. Better to get punished here than there.
But right. Can you be completely absolved by, how does it work? Like, what's written about these?
It's not necessarily completely absolved, but the point is that the suffering that a person undergoes in this world can be partial or total, depending on how much suffering, atonement for his sins in the world to come, and as a result, if he does tshuva with that suffering, he can go straight to Olam Haba without going through any of the tortures of Gehenna. So, very much so. The idea of suffering, and in fact, the word for suffering in Chazal is yisurin. And the Gemara makes the point that even the minor frustrations of life are yisurin that effect kapara. The example the Gemara gives is that if you put your hand in your pocket to take out one coin and you take out a different coin, or you want to take out a shekel and you take out a half shekel. So he says, that's yisurin, you've suffered. If your coffee is cold, we're hoping for a good hot coffee, it's cold in a restaurant, that's yisurin. So a person should be happy when those things happen, because each time those things happen, that's a kapara, right? You don't have a seat on a naked bus, right? Kapara. So that way a person can go through life with a kind of a sense of equanimity, certainly for the smaller frustrations. In a way, the larger frustrations and difficulties is even more of a kapara, but of course it'll also be a bigger tsar and a bigger pain. Right, so all yisurin, and the Gemara Taka says, if a person went through 3 days where everything was perfect, he should begin to worry. Maybe he's getting all of his reward in this world. In other words, life shouldn't be too perfect. Life should be good. One should be happy with their lot, of course, but life shouldn't be absolutely perfect. Then you have to start worrying, gee, God has given me all my reward in this world.
So why do we daven then, that we should get the rewards in this world?
Well, the Rambam writes that all reward in this world, even if it takes the form of physical blessing, is really nothing more than opportunity to serve God by doing more mitzvahs. Mm-hmm. So we ask for health so we may serve. So it's not ultimate reward, it's facilitation of service, of avodas Hashem. That's what the Rambam writes. Okay, so basically that's the dialogue though. So from Rus's responses, Chazal infer all of these halachas, and again, Pasuk Yudchet says that when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to come, she stopped discouraging her. And this, of course, is the prototype of the convert. Initially, your stance is you must discourage the person who wants to be a Jew, because only then do you determine their sincerity. But once they are sincere, you are to embrace them and love them and care about them. And indeed, we are told that in over 30 places, the Torah itself talks about loving the converts, loving the stranger, not making them feel bad. They tell the story about the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish, the great gadol and tzaddik in Bnei Brak, who was once walking on Simchas Torah, and he met a person who recently converted to Judaism. And again, the person had no family for Yom Tov, nobody knew him, etc. How he became a ger, I don't know. It was not that common then. And the Chazon Ish saw that the person was very sad and despondent because he felt lonely and rejected and not having a part of things. So the Chazon Ish, who was in his 70s, began dancing in the middle of the street. You know, the Chazon Ish was not such a demonstrative person either. He was not someone like the Hasidish Rebbe who was always dancing. But the Chazon Ish, just to get a laugh out of the person, you know, was willing to do something that, you know, looked peculiar and etc. Because he said, this is the mitzvah of making the ger feel wanted. And the proof of that halacha is that once Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to stay, she stopped discouraging her. And then they came and they traveled, two women, two lonely, poor women, and they came to Beis Lechem, and all of the city gathered around her, and they said, Hazos Naomi, this is the pun, is this Naomi? Naomi means sweet. Is this the sweet one? But because she doesn't look the same. Vatomer Alehen, and she said to them, Al tikreno li Naomi, do not call me the sweet one. Kareno li Mara, call me the bitter one. Give me the name Mara. Ki hemar shakai li miot, because God has dealt me a bitter hand. Ani malaya halachti, I left full, I left Eretz Yisrael in the fullness of my life. I had a husband, I had children, I had the money. Vareikam hishivani Hashem. But God has brought me back empty-handed. But here there's something very, very fascinating. And that is, the name of Hashem that she uses in this pasuk is Yud Ke Vav Ke, the tetragrammaton, right? The four-letter name of God. Now, we know that the four-letter name of God is always the name of Hashem that expresses mercy. So she's expressing her faith even in this adversity. God brought me back to this land empty, but I still believe in God's mercy. One might even say that what she's saying is, God gave me the merit to come back to the land of Israel. And actually what she's saying is, I'd rather be here impoverished and alone than to be back in what Moab represented. It's kind of a gratitude that at least she's here. And then she says, Hashem Anabi. Hashem, it was God in His mercy who afflicted me. The Shakai and the Almighty God, Heroli. Right, so Ruth and Naomi come back, and they came to Beis Lechem at the beginning of the barley harvest. I had mentioned before that the barley harvest is around Pesach time, and thus they have returned around Pesach time. So the whole story, the rest of the story as it unfolds, is between Pesach and Shavuos. Right, that's the chronological system. Okay, so chapter one deals with introducing the characters. The fact that Naomi had all of this suffering, and the fact that Ruth, her daughter-in-law, comes back. Now, again, we have to always keep in mind that even though now Ruth is a halachic convert, now there are a lot of questions, exactly. Who converted Ruth? I mean, technically, there are three requirements for a male conversion, and two requirements for a female conversion. For the male conversion, the requirement is circumcision, bris mila, going to the mikveh, and acceptance of the commandments. For a woman, the two requirements are mikveh and acceptance of commandments. However, the problem is, all of these requirements cannot just be done privately. They have to be done in the presence of a Beis Din, the presence of a Jewish court of three, we'd call them rabbis, I don't know if they'd be called rabbis then, but three Jews. Now, by the way, the way that works, and that's even true by the woman going to the mikveh, so you may be wondering, gee, I mean, what's going on here? Three rabbis, you know, seeing a woman go to the mikveh. Well, the truth is, it's a little bit of a difficult minuet. Basically, what happens is a woman is ready to go to the mikveh. The three rabbis have to see that the woman is totally under the water. So the way it works is, three rabbis are in the mikveh with their backs to the mikveh. And there's a woman that's in attendance with the woman. When the woman is totally under, the mikveh attendant says, "Now!" So we turn around, we see nothing floating over the top, then we turn away, and we have therefore been witnesses to a total immersion. Right? So it's kind of a little bit of a delicate maneuver, but obviously tzinius is not supposed to be compromised at all in that particular scenario. But the question is, if you need a Beis Din for all of this, then obviously the individual discussion that Naomi has with Rus, even though it involves the idea of telling her accepting the mitzvahs, can obviously not be the conversion itself. So we really don't have a definitive answer in any source, mechanically, when did the conversion take place, but Chazal universally understand that irrespective of whether Rus was a guy when she married Machlon, that's a machlokas, it is absolutely the case that by the time they come to Eretz Yisrael, she is now a halachically valid convert. Right? So we don't know exactly when and where, but at some point this process did take place. Yeah.
So Eretz Yisrael
called the Moavia. Excellent. That's a very, very excellent point. And there are a few reasons here. The one reason is the Megillah wants to emphasize her righteousness, because Moab was a very hated nation. And people still stigmatized Rus. Oh, that's the Moabite woman. So the point is, she was entering a society that naturally was going to be very hostile to her. And by emphasizing that she was still rejected and kind of another strange person, that highlights her righteousness in joining the Jewish people. So it's actually to her credit that she is called Moavia. And that brings me to my other point. Remember that when Rus came back, although the halacha does permit, right, the Torah says male converts, male Moabite converts are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people. Female Moabite converts are allowed to, but as we discussed, this law was not widely known. And consequently, we have to assume that Rus herself, and perhaps Rus thought that her husband's died for that sin. So consequently, the commentaries point out that not only is Rus leaving her comfortable land of Moab to come to Israel and embrace Judaism, but she is going, insofar as she realizes it, she is going to a place where nobody can marry her. In other words, halachically that's not true, but in terms of her perception, and most people's perception, she is the hated Moabite to whom nobody can marry. So once again, we see a glimpse of what her great Mesiras Nefesh is, her great devotion, and her selflessness. Now, there's another interpretation, though, to your question, which is a bit more negative. That is, the Medrash has a saying that a ger does not lose some of their non-Jewish attachments, even for many generations. And it points out that, although Rus was well-intentioned, there's going to be one reference in the Megillah where she made a remark that was not very tznius. Let's see if I remember the pasuk. And the Medrash comments, well, you know, there was still something of the Moabite culture in her that she could...
It
says even for many generations, yeah. Although Rus is only the first...
100 years.
Let me see if I can remember the pasuk. The pasuk was something about, I will harvest with the men. One second. Yes, this is the one. Yeah, if you look at chapter 2, when Rus, verse 7... So Rus made a reference, I will go and harvest the sheaves together with the kotzrim, together with the male harvesters. verse 7, this is chapter 2, verse 7. Right, she said, I will go gather the sheaves with the male harvesters. So it mentions that, and you'll notice that Boaz told her, you're welcome to attach yourself with the women that are harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a concept there that inadvertently, we're not Chas v'Shalom saying that Rus intended anything at all improper, but kind of the way she spoke still connected her somehow to the Moabite immorality. So that's a negative reason why it says Moabiyah. So there are different interpretations. Okay, now we have chapter 2. Now Naomi is a poor woman now, right? She's no longer a wealthy woman. And we are told Naomi has a relative. And now we're introducing, right, these. This is like a well-written play. Each act introduces a new character. So now we have a new character on the scene. And this new character is given some good names. Ish Gibor Chayil. A man, now the word ish means a dignified man, not just a man. A dignified man, Gibor Chayil, a heroic person of valor. But as we know, that in the Tanakh, by and large, valor does not refer to courage on the battlefield, but it refers to spiritual strength, just like Eishes Chayil. A woman of valor does not refer to kind of a Viking woman who takes a sword. It refers to spiritual qualities. So Gibor Chayil, particularly what Pirkei Avos says, a Zeu Gibor, who is a true Gibor, a courageous, strong person, HaKovesh Etz Yitzcho, one who holds back the evil inclination.
It's also in Tehillim, 114. So what's
yeah,
the one of...
Right, there are many. Yeah, Moshe Baruch Milo Chedir, he who conquers, who controls his spirit, is greater than the one who conquers a city. His name is Boaz. Now again, to reiterate, Boaz is known in the book of Judges by the name Ivtsan, and he is one of the judges mentioned in the book of Shoftim. According to Chazal, Boaz just now lost his wife. He had already lost all of his children. Now he's an elderly widower. And what is the, again, what is the connection between Boaz and Naomi? Naomi is his aunt. Remember, because Boaz's father is Salmon. We know that from the end of Megillah. Rashi says Salmon and Elimelech, as well as the third person, are the children of Nachshon ben Aminadav. Therefore, Elimelech was Boaz's uncle, right? The father of Boaz's father. I'm sorry, the brother of Boaz's father, and therefore Naomi is his aunt by marriage. Now, one of the strange things in Perek Beis is, why is Boaz so neglectful? Because what we're going to see is the following. What chapter 2 is going to describe is that Naomi and Ruth have no food in the house. So, based on certain mitzvos, a poor person is allowed to follow the harvesters and pick up stuff that's forgotten. So she sends Rus out. Naomi is too old to do this. She sends Rus out to do this. And by accident, at least intentionally, by accident, she happens to be in the field of Boaz, who is Naomi's relative. And what does Boaz do after he discovers this amazing coincidence? He gives her permission to continue to glean. So there are a lot of problems here. First of all, why hasn't Boaz taken any initiative to take care of Naomi, his aunt? And second of all, even after he finds out, what's the big deal? He gives Ruth the same right as any other beggar. He should have, you know, taken them in and given them money and supported them. So Boaz's behavior is a little strange here on many, many levels, particularly since he's described as a Gibor Chayil. Now, some have suggested that one of the explanations is that Boaz did not want to shame Naomi, that sometimes there is a concept for me to go over to you and say, oh, you're poor, let me take care of you, would have created a tremendous amount of embarrassment and shame, and consequently, Boaz did not want to initiate help. It's a difficult dilemma, because on one hand, you need help, but on the other hand, maybe your dignity is more important than whatever help I give you. Now, that doesn't necessarily explain the second problem, though. In other words, once Boaz sees that Ruth is reduced to gleaning, why doesn't he give them special treatment there? Again, it's not clear. Some have suggested a different approach. Some have suggested that Boaz thought that Naomi and Ruth, well, number one, how did he regard Ruth? He may have regarded Ruth at that point in his life as this hated Moabite woman who's not allowed to enter Judaism. You know, she's making the same mistake as everybody else. And consequently, just like we'd have today, when there's an intermarriage, etc., sometimes we make distance. Maybe he felt, you know, what is Naomi doing bringing that woman home? The woman that may have caused the death of Mahlon the Chilion and everything else, right? So it's not clear. Maybe Boaz is a victim of the same halachic ignorance at this point that everyone else has. But we should make a note, though, that Boaz's behavior is a little peculiar. Now, to understand, though, the events in chapter 2, the procedure, let me go over some mitzvahs in the Torah. It's important to know the various things that poor people are empowered to do with respect to crops in the land of Israel. Actually, it's interesting. This is not practiced today, and there's some question why this is not practiced today, but let me go over it. The basic three gifts to the poor from crops are leket, shichicha, and peah. Let's take peah first, because peah is the easiest to explain. Peah literally means corners of the field. And the halacha is that when I harvest a field in the land of Israel, I am supposed to leave some grain at the corners. Actually, it could be anywhere in the field, but typically it was at the corners, standing right, which I do not harvest, in order for the poor to be able to take that at their leisure. Now, how much grain do I have to leave standing? Well, if you recall, this is a Mishnah that we recite every single day. Eilu devarim she'ein lahem shiur. The following things have no minimum amount, and the first one that's mentioned is hapeya. So under the Torah, you could leave one stalk of grain, and that would be enough. Rabbinically, the Rabbanan were masaking, you should leave 1/60th. Right? So 1/60th is it's less than 2%. 2% is 1/50th. So, right? You leave 1/60th as peah. Now, the halacha is that if you didn't leave the peah, you then have to separate it from harvested grain. If you didn't do that, you have to separate it from flour and eventually from dough. But ideally, you separate the peah in the field itself. That is peah. Now, peah is an intentional gift, meaning you must leave it for the poor. But then we have other things which are more like kind of accidental gifts, and that is leket. Leket is when I'm harvesting grain. Now imagine how you harvest grain in the olden days, probably in some countries today. You take a handful of grain in one hand, and then you have a sickle in the other hand. And what happens is often when you cut, like when you break spaghetti, right, there might be a piece of grain that was originally in the sickle that falls over. That is what leket is. So the halacha is the grain that falls out of the sickle in the process of cutting has to be left for the poor. So they would glean and they would actually pick it up. Now imagine, you can imagine it would be somewhat of a madhouse. There'd be a lot of, there might be 100 poor people in a given field, and whichever one gets it first gets it. That is leket. Now here it's a complicated halacha because leket applies only for one grain or one stalk or two stalks per cut. If there's already three stalks or more, the balabayit is entitled to pick it up. So how the poor person is supposed to see that so carefully is a very, very difficult thing. Meaning, if I'm cut and three stalks fall out, the poor person can take two of them, but one of them needs to be left for the balabayit. That's leket. Now, the third gift for the poor is also an accidental gift, and that's called shichicha. Now, shichicha basically means after the grain was harvested and bound into sheaves, and the whole day they would be making sheaves the whole day, and then at the end of the day they would collect the sheaves. If in the course of collecting the sheaves, a sheaf was left behind, it was forgotten. So you cannot go back and take it. That must be left for the poor as well. Now, based on this, there's a common misconception in the story of Ruth. People think that if I'm a harvester carrying a sheaf of grain, people, in other words, people have the picture of the poor people following the harvesters holding the grain with the grain falling behind them and gleaning, and I think that's what emerges from the English translation. Halachically, that's not true, because it's only either the leket, which falls at the time of the harvest, or the sheaves that are left behind because they were forgotten. But there's no concept of dropped sheaves. In other words, if I'm carrying something and it drops from me, I'm certainly allowed to go and pick it up. Right? So just to understand the halachas here. So what is described in chapter 2 is the classic instance of following the harvesters to pick up the grain that falls as they harvest the grain. This is considered to be the idea of leket. Okay, so leket is the mitzvah that we are describing. I wanted to say one other thing. Now that's for grain. That's for grain, just to be complete. What do we have for fruit trees? So for fruit trees, we do not have peya per se, but we have the same concept of called peret, meaning as you harvest fruit trees, what falls as you cut, say, some branches off, the fruit that falls beyond your knife, beyond your sickle, that also belongs to the poor. So we have analogies for that as well. I'm sorry, what was that time? Yeah.
10 times.
Oh, okay. Okay, let's stop here, then we'll continue next week. Okay.
Okay.
We're still on Eric Aleph of Megillas Rus. And we're now discussing Naomi decides to go back. Her two daughters-in-law want to follow her, but she discourages them from following. So actually, I just want to show you that we discussed yesterday the big machlokas of whether Rus and Orpah had converted when they married Machlon v'Chilion, or whether they didn't convert, or whether, as the Zohar states, they did convert, but there was some question as to the sincerity of conversion. I do want to point out to you a very interesting Rashi. Rashi's opinion in his commentary on Rus is that Rus and Orpah did not convert, and Machlon and Chilion married non-Jewish women. It's based on a Medrash, but what Rashi extracts it from a very, very ingenious interpretation. If you look at... look at verse 12. Verse 12, Perek Aleph, this is on page 1269. This is chapter 1, verse 12. This is in the middle of Naomi's impassioned speech, so I'll read the English. Shovna benosai, turn back my daughters. Lechna, go home. Ki zakanti nios la'ish, because I am too old to have a husband, and ki, in other words, there's not going to be another child I have that you could marry. Ki amarti yeshli tikva, and even if I would have hope, and this very night I would be with the man, and I would be able to have children. She's saying she's not going to have kids again, but even if I would miraculously be able to get pregnant this very night, so verse 13. Would you wait for them until they are grown up? Halohen teogena, will you anchor yourselves? Right, this is the word aguna. And aguna is a chained or anchored woman, typically whose husband disappeared. Or today, the more modern aguna is the husband is unfortunately around, but refuses to give his wife a get. We call those women agunot. But this is the biblical use of the term. Halohen teogena. For them will you anchor yourself, not to be to another man. Now, the simple meaning of the verse is very simple. Naomi's basically saying, I'm not going to have kids again, and if I would have kids again, are you going to wait 20 years till you could marry them? But Rashi gives it a halachic twist. Rashi says, the twist is this, you have to understand the mitzvah of Yibam, that the mitzvah of Yibam says, right, the halachic mitzvah of Yibam, that if a man dies without children, there's a mitzvah on his brother to marry the widow. Right? That's the mitzvah of Yibam. However, the Mishnah in Yevamos teaches us that the mitzvah of Yibam does not apply to a brother who was not yet born when his brother died. The example would be, let's say a married man dies without children, but he's relatively young. So his mother is then pregnant or becomes pregnant and gives birth to a boy. Now that is a posthumous brother. That is a brother that is born after the death of the first brother. So the halakha is the widow does not have to wait until the boy grows up, but a brother that is not born until after the death of the brother, there is no obligation of yibum whatsoever. Now you see the difference here. If a man dies and he has a one-day-old brother who was just born that day, the woman has to wait until that boy becomes bar mitzvah, and then she could get chalitza from him, or yibum, theoretically a 13-year-old could do yibum as well. So if the boy is even one day old, the woman will have to wait many, many years until she'll be allowed to be released, because a child below bar mitzvah cannot have the chalitza ceremony. If, on the other hand, the child was not born until after the death of the first brother, so then there's no yibum or chalitza requirement at all. This is based on a drasha where the Torah describes yibum ki yeshvu achim yachdav. When brothers have lived together and one of them dies, so the interpretation is that the brothers must have shared a common existence, even if it's only for a day. So Rashi says the following. How can Naomi make the argument? Naomi implies that if she would have another child, that child would be able to marry Rus and Orpah, but they're not going to want to wait for so many years. But how could they do that? Any brother that is born after the death of Machlon V'Chilya, there wouldn't be a mitzvah of Yibam, because the brothers did not share a common existence. And not only that, I should add the following. Not only is there no mitzvah of Yibam, but in fact it's a prohibited union. Meaning, a brother is not allowed to marry the widow of a brother who did not live in the same time. So the question is, how could Naomi imply that the only problem is the waiting? So Rashi's answer is, since Rus and Orpah were never halachically married to Machlon V'Chilya, and the reason is because they were goyim who had not yet converted, now that Rus or Orpah would convert, they theoretically would be halachically permitted to marry Naomi's future children, which is why she predicates that they won't do so, because of the difficulties of waiting. So Rashi actually uses that halacha as evidence, as textual evidence, that Rus and Orpah were halachically not Jewish. Obviously there are different ways of answering that, but this is the shita of Rashi, that Rus and Orpah had not gone to the mikveh, they had not yet converted, and the conversion discussion is taking place right now. Of course, as I indicated, the main question on that interpretation is the discussion at the end of the Megillas Rus, when Boaz is said to marry Rus in order to perpetuate the seed of Mahlon. If Rus never had a marriage with Mahlon, there would be no concept of perpetuating the seed.
But if they were not converted,
mm-hmm.
then reflects on the character.
Yes, that's correct. Of course, that also leads to the conclusion that Mahlon v'Chilion, even Machlon, the so-called more righteous one, committed the very, very grievous and serious aveira of marrying a non-Jewish woman. Now indeed, I should also say though, that on Rashi's side, there is the authority as eminent as the Targum. Right? We know that all the books of the Bible have an Aramaic translation that dates from the time of the Second Temple. And on Chumash, the primary Aramaic translation is called the Targum of Uncleus. Targum means the translation of Uncleus. Uncleus was a convert, a Roman convert who was actually in the family of the Emperor of Rome. And he embraced Judaism and wrote the Aramaic translation. And on the books of the Nevi'im, the primary Targum is the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. Okay, so the Targum, if you open up a Yehoshua and you see a Targum in it, in the big, you know, only the ones with commentaries, that is actually Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. And who is Targum Yonasan ben Uziel? Again, Yonasan ben Uziel is a very interesting person. He is buried up north in a place called Amuka. Amuka literally means deep valley, and indeed he's buried in a very deep valley. You have to go down 100 or so steps, and he's buried really at the foot of a valley. He was considered to be the greatest of Hillel's disciples. in terms of his learning, and it says when birds would fly over him while he was learning, they would be burnt by the fire. That means the angels would come to listen, and their fire would destroy birds. And he wrote the Targum on the books of the Nevi'im. It is said he then wanted to write a Targum on the books of the Kesuvim. But when he did that, there was a tremendous earthquake, and God ordered him not to do it, because in the Kesuvim, particularly the book of Daniel, we have various calculations about the coming of the Mashiach, which are very obscure. But if he would have clarified all those calculations, the world would be given information that they are not supposed to be given in a clear and explicit way. So the Targum on the Kesuvim is not from Yonas ben Uzziel. Now, nevertheless, we do find that a number of books in the Kesuvim do have a Targum. For example, the Megillos all have a Targum. Esther has a Targum. Rus has a Targum, etc. And it's not really clear who the author is. We know that the Targum of the Torah is Onkelos, and we know that the Targum of the Nevi'im is Yonas ben Uzziel. We don't really have a definitive authorship of any of the Targumim on the books of the Kesuvim. Sometimes it is erroneously attributed to Yonas ben Uzziel, but we know that's an impossibility, because the Gemara tells us very explicitly that Yonas ben Uzziel did not write a Targum on the Kesuvim. But anyway, for purposes of those who are not married in the room, one should know that journeys to the kever of Yonas ben Uzziel are considered to be very auspicious for getting a shidduch. So people go to that kever, and they pray to find their marriage partner. And there are many, many stories of this actually happening, kind of, you know, the old left my sitter there story, you know, kind of, you know, boy leaves sitter with his name and address at the kever by accident. Girl, you know, picks up sitter, calls up boy, you know, to return the sitter, and they get married. Sometimes it's girl leaves sitter, and boy calls up. But either way, it happens a lot. But there are many, many stories about the segula, the bracha of going to the kever of Yonas ben Uzziel. So, but doesn't hurt, as they say. So if you're up there, it's worthwhile to see. But I'm bringing this in merely because the Targum on Megillas Rus says very, very specifically that Machlon v'Chilyo died because they committed the sin of marrying a non-Jewish woman. So the Targum follows Rashi's opinion that Machlon v'Chilion did not marry converted Jewesses, but actually married non-Jewish women. So Rashi and the Targum both have that particular shita. Okay. Now, it goes on. I'm just going to read another part of Rashi inside. Okay, so Orpah goes back, and remember the word Orpah, Oref, is the back of the neck. So she turned her head away from Naomi, so she was given the name Orpah. And again, as I indicated, although her parents, when they named her, didn't know she would do that, but, you know, as it were, God decreed that the parents gave her that name, because indeed she turned her Oref, the back of her neck, to Naomi. And then Rus stays, and Naomi tells Rus, why don't you go back? And then we have one of the famous verses in Tanakh, and that's verse 16, that says, Vatomer Rus. Rus says to her mother-in-law, Al tifki bi, do not entreat me, liyazveich, to forsake you, lashuv miacharayach, to return away from you, ki el asher telchi eilech, where you go, eilech, I will go. Will be asher tolini olin, where you lodge, I will lodge. Ameich ami, your nation is now my nation. Ve'elokayach, and your God is Elokoi, is my God. And then she goes on, ba'asher tamusi amus, and as you will die, so will I die, meaning even willingness to die. Ve'shama ka'akaber, and there I wish to be buried. Ko yasel Hashem li v'cho Yosef, and so shall God do to me, ki hamaves, that only death, yafrid beini uveinech, shall separate between you and me. Right? One of the most beautiful and selfless declarations. But here, there's a very important Rashi that infers, again, it's based on a Gemara in Maseches Shivamos, that infers some very important halachos here. And let me read you the whole Rashi inside. Essentially, the approach that Rashi takes is, from what Rus tells Naomi, we infer what Naomi must have told Rus. In other words, Rus's rhetoric here is responding to things that Naomi said to her. So we work backwards. From Rus's answers, we can see what Naomi was telling her. Now, what was Naomi telling her? So Rashi says, Mikan Omru Rabboseinu Zichronam Levracha. From here, our rabbis of blessed memory said the following. Ger Shebal Lehiskayir, when a non-Jew comes to be converted, now again, this is consistent with Rashi's opinion that Rus and Orpah were non-Jews. So now, Rus is coming to convert. Modiyin lo miktas onshin, we inform them, we don't have to give them the whole Torah. In other words, you don't have to get rabbinical ordination before you become converted to Judaism, but we give them a sampling representative of various punishments. Shiim ba'lachsor, if they want to change their mind, they should change their mind. And therefore, the concept is this. We're going to infer from Rus's responses what Naomi said. The first thing Naomi said to Rus is, on Shabbos, we're not allowed to go beyond a tchum. What's a tchum? Tchum means that you are given a radius of 2,000 amos every Shabbos from what is halachically defined as your residence. Now that's a very tricky question. Halachically, your residence is not merely your home, but it is the town that you're situated in. Now, if you're living out in the middle of the desert, you indeed only have a radius of 2,000 amos from your house. That means 2,000 amos is approximately, at most, 4,000 feet, about 1 kilometer. So you can go 1 kilometer in every direction. If you take one step, people don't realize it's not just the halacha that says you're not allowed to do it, but it's very severe if you do it. If you take one step beyond that radius, you are essentially frozen in spot. You cannot go back home. Okay, you're really going to be limited there for all of Shabbos, unless, of course, it's a matter of life and death, which, of course, you could violate this anyway. Now, in urban areas, it's a very, very different story, because it is still true that you're given the radius of 2,000 from your residence, but when there's continuity of houses, your residence keeps on going. So until the houses stop, or until there's a certain significant spacing between the houses, it keeps on going. So the 2,000 amos don't begin until you're beyond the periphery of all of those houses. So the first thing Naomi tells Rus is, you don't want to be a Jew. It's interesting why she picks this one. You know, you figure that I pick something else. She says, Jews can't walk beyond a certain distance on Shabbos. Apparently, maybe she knew that her daughter-in-law liked to take long, long walks. So that's why Rus says, the first thing Rus says is, where you go, I will go. Meaning, you can go only this far, I will go only this far. Right? So we're working backwards. From the answer, we infer what Naomi would have said. Second question, or the second halacha. We are not allowed to even be in the same room with a man that we're not married to. This is the Yisur of Yichud. A woman cannot be alone with a man. That is why Rus says, what's the second thing she says? Where you sleep, where you spend the night, is where I spend the night. If the halacha does not allow us to spend, you to spend the night in a man's home that you're not married to, then I will abide by that halacha. Then the third is more of a general thing. The Jewish people are separated with the burdens of 613 commandments. That is the reference, your nation is my nation. Whatever makes the Jewish people a nation is what I accept. It is forbidden to worship idols. That's why Rus says, your God is my God. I accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu fully. Then Naomi brings up the fact that halacha does not just have obligations, but halacha also has punishments. There are four types of death penalties for various averos, right? What are the four death penalties? There is stoning, which is a little bit of a misnomer, because stoning we think of as throwing stones. That's not really the way it was done. Really, stoning meant a person was pushed off a cliff and they would break their neck or break their bones on the stones below. There is stoning. There is burning, which also is not the common image. Burning you think of being burned at the stake. In fact, burning is pouring molten lead down a person's throat. Okay, I'll discuss some of that because it sounds very, very horrific. That's Serefa. The third is Hereg. Hereg is decapitation by the sword, like the guillotine or a sword. And the fourth is Chenek, which is strangulation. And there the idea was that a rope or a cloth would be wrapped around the neck of a person and it would be pulled by the two witnesses. Strangulation. Now, these are four death penalties that the Torah prescribes for various sins. So Naomi is telling Rus, you know, well, we have death penalties when you become Jewish, and that's why Rus says, the way you die is the way I'll die, meaning I'm willing to accept even those penalties, and there I will be buried. Now, just a few words, Derech Agav, in terms of these death penalties, just to give you an example of each. Stoning is the penalty that the Torah prescribes perhaps for what you might regard as the most serious of averos, idol worship, desecration of the Shabbos and the like, that involves stoning. Burning is involved for certain types of sexual offenses, strangulation for others. For homicide, the punishment would be decapitation. Now, the most important thing to keep in mind is that although you look in the Torah, and there are so many averos which have the death penalty, right? So it seems to be that people were executed every other day. In fact, the Gemara tells us that the requirements in order to execute a person were so strict and so high that it was almost impossible. It says the Sanhedrin executed one person either every 7 years, according to one view, or according to another view, every 70 years. That was considered a bloody Sanhedrin. It almost never happens. Because first of all, O.J. Simpson would not have gotten convicted under the procedures in a Sanhedrin, because the Sanhedrin did not rely on circumstantial evidence. The Sanhedrin required eyewitness testimony. Somebody had to see that the person was killed. And what type of eyewitnesses do you need? You need two eyewitnesses. They cannot be related to either the victim or the perpetrator. They cannot be related to each other. They have to be Jewish. They have to be bar mitzvah. They have to be male. And they have to be halachically observant. Those types of people don't hang around murder scenes that much, right? Wherever it's going to be, right? So you need that. The witnesses were cross-examined separately by the Beis Din. And if there was even a minor discrepancy in their story, even over insignificant details, it was thrown out. So if the Beis Din would ask the person, what color tie was the victim wearing? And one person said red stripe, and the other person said red plaid, that would be enough to invalidate their testimony. In order to sentence a person to death, you had to have a court of 23 judges. And the decision had to be made by at least a majority of two for conviction. A majority of one would not be enough. So if in a 23-judge court you had, let us say, 12 versus 11, 12 for conviction, that wasn't enough. Now actually, if you think about it, in truth, it's impossible to have a majority of two in odd number. In other words, 12-11 is a majority of one, that's not enough, so you're going to have 13-10. So you have a majority of three, but according to halacha, huh? Well, yeah, I understand. You know, it's hard to find a half judge. But in theory, a majority of two is sufficient. There's also a requirement that in order to convict a person and give them the death sentence, the person needed to be warned before he commits the act. And he needed to acknowledge the warning, and he had to commit the act right after the warning, within like 5 seconds. So the conditions for this capital punishment were extremely rare. So one should not, God forbid, think of the Torah as creating a system of bloodthirsty vigilante justice. Now, the only thing is, you may ask, well, if in fact it is true that capital punishment was almost never administered. So there's one other unusual halakha, or two other unusual halakhas I want to mention. Yeah, one is that Jewish law totally rejects a confession as evidence of guilt, at least for these types of punishments. A guy comes in and says, I did it. The halakha is, we'll tell him, have a good day, go home. this is the rule that says, Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. A person is not believed to declare that he is an evil man who committed such an act. Now, it's very important to know that there's a big difference between what you would call civil disputes and criminal. If I walk in and I confess that I borrowed $100 from you, that's a monetary obligation, then we say the opposite. The admission of a litigant that he owes money is worth more than 100 witnesses. So when it comes to civil liability, or even if I say, I burnt down your house, I owe you money, anything that involves owing money, admissions of guilt are considered very, very halakhically authoritative. But when it comes to criminal punishment, like death penalties or lashes, confessions are totally inadmissible. It's interesting, you know, that's very different. Let me just compare that to American law for a minute. Because people sometimes compare this to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, where you have a what's called a privilege against self-incrimination. That's when the person says, I refuse to answer that question on the ground that it may incriminate me. But it's very important to know the difference between the halakhic rule and the American constitutional rule. The privilege against self-incrimination merely says you have the right to remain silent and not answer any questions that may lead to your imprisonment or incarceration. If, however, after being properly appraised and warned of your right, you decline to exercise it, that's the old case that's called the Miranda warnings, that comes from a Supreme Court case, where the police say you have the right to remain silent, anything you say can be used against you, etc. If you hear that warning, and you then say, I want to talk anyway, then your confession is admissible. You can certainly go to jail because of your confession. In halacha, it's not merely that you have a privilege not to come forward, but it goes much, much further. Even if you come forward and testify, your confession is inadmissible. So that's much, much further than the Fifth Amendment. Now the question is, why is there such a rule? So the Rambam says the following reason. The Rambam says that confessions are actually considered to be unreliable evidence of guilt. Very interesting. You know, we might have thought a confession is the strongest evidence. He says a confession is weak. And the reason is, the Rambam writes, many crazy people like to confess to crimes that they never committed. Now, the truth of the matter is, this is an observation that is actually borne out. You know, whenever there's a series of murders, serial killers, the police literally get hundreds of calls from people who claim to have done it, and the police don't even follow up on a lot of them because they say, well, this guy always calls up no matter what happens. Because there is a concept that either there are people who are masochistic, who want to punish themselves for whatever reason, or people want to act out the fantasy of being again, the pathology of crime is, you know, there's a certain fantasy of being a master over other people's lives and deaths. And therefore they actually get pleasure out of claiming that they did some horrendous act, even though they actually, the police may know that they didn't do it. So the Rambam focuses on confessions as being unreliable evidence. There's another reason that one might give as well, and that is from a sociological standpoint. One can look at the inadmissibility of confessions as a way of deterring misconduct on the part of law enforcement. I'll give you an example. Because if confessions would be admissible, this might give an incentive to the police to torture people in order to extract a confession. But if the Torah in effect says, no matter what you get out of the guy, he can't be convicted, that removes an incentive on the part of law enforcement to engage in abusive techniques. In fact, it's a very ingenious idea. In other words, essentially, a police is now given the message, there is no benefit in your torturing and extracting a confession from somebody, because even if you get it, the guy's not going to be sentenced. Right? So one can look at it from a sociological standpoint as a prophylactic against the excessive abuses of law enforcement. Be it as it may, it is a unique feature of Jewish law that confessions in criminal matters are not admissible. Now, the closest we have in American law, besides the Fifth Amendment, is a rule in some states that does say that confessions need to be corroborated with some other evidence, such as a body. Meaning to say, in some states, if I just walk in and I say I killed somebody, but, you know, there's no body that was found, there's no weapon that was found, in some states that is not enough to convict. You need something else besides. So that is a little bit similar, but still, if you have that something else, the confession is admissible, which is not true under Jewish law. Yeah, did you want to say?
Can one Jew bear witness to that Jewish law?
Yeah, okay, I'm going to modify what I'm going to say now in a few moments, but in the classic Sanhedrin procedure, non-Jews are not admissible witnesses, nor are women, and nor are children below the age of bar mitzvah. Now, I'll discuss some modifications for that shortly. Now, so that's one feature, the inadmissibility of confessions. A second unusual feature is a rule that may be uncommon, but it's an amazingly difficult rule to understand. That is, if there is a unanimous vote for conviction, all 23 judges conclude that the guy is guilty, the guy goes free. Meaning if it's 22-1, he gets killed. If it's 23-0, he goes free. And that's a very, very difficult halacha. And in fact, think about this from the perspective of the 23rd judge. Let's assume the guilt is so clear that 22 of the judges have voted guilty. And I'm now the 23rd judge. I also believe he's guilty. How should I vote? Now here's the dilemma. If I vote based on my belief that he's guilty, the guy's going to go free, because now it's 23-0. If I vote on the basis of innocence, which I don't believe, that will actually carry out my belief that he's guilty, because then it will be 22-1, you see? So the Gemara actually says that in spite of this rule, you have to vote the truth, meaning you have to vote that the person is guilty, if that is your belief, even though the result of that vote is the guy's going to get off. In other words, you can't pervert the truth, even to, it's the, you know, it's the means not justifying the ends not justifying the means under those circumstances. Now, what is the logic of that rule? I mean, the rule is very, very, very perplexing, and even the Rishonim have stated that it's one of the halachos that is really almost defies our understanding, but the fear seems to be that